This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. These days, we talk about witch hunts most often in a metaphorical sense. We forget, or perhaps we never learned, the very real, very grisly history of the witch hunts and how they've shaped society today. Max Dashue's life's work is focused on uncovering women's suppressed histories, which has meant delving into the long and ugly history of the witch hunts, which have been substantially glossed over and truncated by male-written history books. Understanding the gendered nature of the witch hunts and the ongoing impacts of silencing women's speech that began so long ago but resonate in frighteningly similar patterns today is imperative if we wish to avoid repeating history and in order for women to fight back against patriarchal oppression. I spoke with Max over the phone last week. Here's that interview. Where and when did this fear of witches and witchcraft originate in the first place?
Well, that's a really complicated question, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I mean, what I'm trying to track in this my series, Secret History of the Witches, is what happened in Europe, that context. I mean, you have the use of witch persecution as a patriarchal tool in many parts of the world. And so, you know, we even currently now have witch hunts in India, Nepal, parts of Africa, Papua New Guinea, a lot of different places. So this is one tool in the patriarchal toolkit. But in the European context, some of this goes back so far that we can't really track it. Like, for example, burning at the stake, we know was a Roman punishment, but it may predate the Romans. And it gets really murky because we don't have written records past a certain point as we go back in time. You know, so there's examples of Greek and Roman witch persecutions where burning is being used, but there's very little documentation. I have some, you know, and so that's one area. There are references to this happening in the Germanic world. Again, very, very slim evidence about it. So that, and even in the Semitic world, you have some ideas around burning of the stake as a form of punishment for female sexual, basically resistance to the sexual double standard, you know, female sexual expression. So in, I don't remember if it's Leviticus, priests' daughters who are fornicators will be burned and things like that. So this use of fire and also any of the elements to execute accused witches is something you see in a lot of places. Drowning, stoning, burning, burial alive in some cases.
Mm.
And so in the Secret History of the Witches, I'm basically trying to track how this whole process happened. And there's a lot of complex factors going on. You have the Imperial Roman patriarchal state, and it may be what we know, what I would call the first known mass witch hunt was in Rome in the end of the, is around 186 BCE, and this was a religious persecution against the women's mysteries. And the historian Titus Livius says that 7,000 people were executed by the Roman state for basically carrying on night ceremonies and processions, and a lot of goddess veneration involved in this, and all kinds of accusations, some of which recur in the mass witch hunts of later European history are being used. And, you know, the idea that this is all a corruption of women and a corruption of the family and things like that. And so then you have the factor of Christianization of this Roman Empire. And so there's an authoritarian state that then takes on this role as a religious enforcer, suppression of pagan or heathen ways is part of that. But it's also something that we're looking, when we're looking at Europe in the early Middle Ages, these are patriarchal societies. Mm. You know, that's clear. Indo-European societies are all patriarchal societies. And so that's a factor that, you know, if you really get into the sources and dig in, you can see bits and pieces there of the sexual politics that's going on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so there's several factors. There's the sexual politics, there's the anti-pagan politics, there is the use of state force. And then as the Middle Ages go on, you have increasingly the revival of torture, which was used by the Greeks and Romans, torture, judicial torture. It set off these mass hunts, you know, that there would be this testeria, I'm not going to use the word hysteria, so I'll call it a testeria, of horrific charges and spread of accusations and more torture leading to more trials and more burnings, and that's where we get the mass witch hunts. So that revival of Roman law had its part in this. Another part that's very important is that the church defined any other spiritual experience or culture than its own Christian doctrine as devil worship. And so this had its effect internally within Europe, in the ethnic folk cultures of Europe. The definition of healers or women's belief in goddesses or shamanic traditions all being tied to a devil. Their own testimony that the people did not talk about devils at all. They talked about women who went by night with the goddess. And this is the current volume that I'm getting ready to publish really documents how this whole process came about. You know, so women who went by night with the goddess Diana, or they call her Diana, goddess of the pagans. So these are the priests writing. But occasionally they would let the name of a local ethnic goddess slip through. And one of these names, they call her the witch Holda. And so that one fragment gives us a connection to a whole body of Germanic goddess tradition in among the common people. And the Frau Holla, Frau Perchta, and there's a lot of different names that this goddess goes by. The changing of definitions by the priesthood of this folk goddess veneration into a concept of devil worship, which I'm called diabolism, you know, this diabolous ideology of the clergy, is something that spreads through repression by both church and state, and this is really what is a major ingredient in the mass witch hunts that really begin to gather steam in the 1400s and really begin to burn large numbers at the stake in the 15 and 1600s.
And there's this thing that you've written about and you've talked about a bit just now, which is that what could be called old spirituality was more favorable to women than the institutionalized Christianity yeah. that followed. So, yeah. you know, how did that change take place, and how did that play into the efforts to suppress and destroy what was seen as witchcraft and witches?
Right. Well, that was a big rationale of the repression, is that, you know, the ideology of the churchmen was that only they could preside over any religious ceremony, which could not be ecstatic, which could not partake of any indigenous ways. You know, it had to be really controlled and hierarchical. And so this repression was at first, you know, you have, I mean, it's not just burning at the stake. Like in the early Middle Ages, they were flogging people. They were enslaving them and confiscating their property in order to repress people who kept to these old ethnic ways. Later on, you have more and more burning coming into play, and there's already in the early Middle Ages laws on some of the books that are talking about burning at the stake. But there are no trial records to go by from that period. So, you know, how all this happened is, it's tricky. It's a very complex picture. So, you know, one of the most I would say the single most dramatic example of female spiritual leadership that we have documented in European culture is in Scandinavia, where the primary spiritual leadership was happening by seeresses who were called vuller, and that means staff women. And so we see this documented in the Eddic poems, in the sagas, and now, just in the last 30, 40 years, in archaeology, they are beginning to realize that the iron and wooden stabs that were buried with some women were actually the stabs that the staff women used in their ceremonies. And so I have a whole chapter in my book, Witches and Pagans, which is talking about these stabs and the trance ceremonies, the seder, that were carried out by these women. So this is not something that is conjectural. We actually have it documented both in written form and in archaeological form. And what's interesting about this is it also ties into some of this goddess culture that I was talking about, because many of these iron staves that have survived in female burials, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and even the larger Viking world over to Russia and to Ireland, the staves were in the shape of a distaff. And that's a tool that women use. They drape the wool or the flax that they're about to spin around the distaff, and then they pull it off and they spin from it. And so it's a symbol of goddesses in ancient times, and including in the early Middle Ages, and it's also a symbol of the fates. And it's used ceremonially. There's a huge connection of the distaff with witchcraft, as well as the idea of female authority more generally. For example, in English, the distaff side is an expression that refers to the maternal line or to women's power. And so this is really pervasive in European culture. And so when this archaeology, they started finding these burials of women with these iron staves, and they didn't recognize what they were. And so the archaeologists were going, well, you know, women cook, they must be meat spits. And gradually, in the last 30 years, there's become more of a recognition that, no, these are the staves of the vulva, the staff woman, and who presides over ceremonies that you would have a circle of women gather around this woman, and she would be on a ceremonial platform, and they would sing special trance songs, and she would go into ecstasy and prophecy. And so this is something that we know about because Scandinavia was Christianized much later. And so their oral traditions survived long enough to be written down in the Christian era. And they were, as in Ireland, they were written down by monks. So there's all this problematic interference with the original material. But nevertheless, a lot of evidence was preserved that way about the existence of this female ceremonial authority. And so when we look at this from the standpoint of sexual politics, what we have to realize is that both, this was a patriarchal society, a male-dominated society. The Vikings, after all, are, you know, warrior culture. They're pirates. They're going around and enslaving women, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there is a survival of a female sphere of power, which is basically driven down in the period between 1000 and, well, just over the next couple hundred years after the year 1000. And, you know, it's stamped out.
Now, I think that a lot of people, when they think of the witch trials and the witch hunts, they think of some that as being something that happened in Europe. And, you know, maybe between the 1500s and the 1700s, but that's not true. You know, where else was this kind of thing going on? And you know, how long did this extend for?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really hard to answer that question because, again, evidence, where do you find evidence of this? I mean, just finding women in history is already a difficult thing to uncover. And then to find evidence of specific patriarchal repression, you know, a lot of sources did not regard that as important, right? In the case of Europe, what the dates you named are the classic, you know, current witchcraft scholarship is like, yeah, well, you know, there was 250 years of the witch hunt. It went on a much longer time than that. It was 1,000 years, you know, in degree, it varied, and it certainly built up to a huge outbreak in that time period that they're talking about, but it's longer. And for the rest of the world, you know, it's really hard to say, you know, how... Okay, example, India. We do have a written record in India, and there are not records of witch persecutions per se, but we have mythic references to witches, and so there is the witch Holika, and the Holi Festival is named from, you know, connected with her name. And so there's this idea that she had somehow harmed some young man or boy and, you know, cast spells on him. And then there's some symbolism of fire that comes into that. And I don't have all the information right in front of me, but you see references to demonized witch stereotypes that show up in other cultures outside of Europe. And so, but it's not easy. You know, a lot of what we're finding on a global level is you have to go by sources that come, they're colonial sources. And so that they're problematic from that standpoint. But nevertheless, we can say that there were a lot of witch hunts going on in different African societies in that colonial period. And you have, sometimes they're connected with Christianization. You have application of older witch hunt tropes from the ethnic cultures that are combined with the missionary ideology that has come in under the English ruler, whoever is the colonial power.
Mm. Now, what are the witch trials? And, you know, what kinds of things were women being tried for? And, you know, how did those trials play out?
Well, there's a couple different categories of the trials. One important group are the inquisitorial trials, which is what a lot of people think of when they talk about witch trials. And so here we have the demonologist or the diabolist ideology is ruling, and you have Dominican friars and others later leading trials that are really ideological. But the accusations, where the accusations came from, you have a whole group of different rationales for them. You know, sometimes the accusation of devil worship. You have husbands accusing their wives in order to get rid of them. You know, a lot of sexual politics in this. Some of the accusations have to do with idea, especially in the later witch hunt period, any kind of female freedom or mobility, speech especially, resistant female speech, angry speech. You know, a woman is mistreated in some way, abused, and she speaks angrily back to that person. If something happens to him, then bang, she's accused. She created this. She cast a spell on him. Mm. This is a lot of it. So the inquisitorial piece is important, not because of the sheer numbers, but because of the way that the accusations developed out of the demonologist mindset and how those ideas spread through the torture trials into the mass cultures in Europe. And so you have secular trials, which really predate the Inquisition. You know, again, there's a combination of church and state going on there, but the early witch hunting laws of the early Middle Ages, you have laws by kings and lords. We don't have a lot of documentation because they didn't keep trial records, you know, before, well, it depends where you are in Europe, but, you know, sometimes no trial records before 1100. Other places, you don't even get trial records until, like, the 1500s. Sometimes they were never kept or they were destroyed. So a lot of this is conjectural. But you have both secular and religious authorities participating in this. And, you know, really the secular witch hunts are the worst. I mean, even under that category, you would have to include some of the bishops were secular lords. And so they were acting as witch hunters in both capacities. You have some examples of women who were subjected to incestuous rape, who are beginning to speak out about it in diabolist terms. And so, you know, that the devil came to me at night. You know, there's all these ways that this was such a predominant framework. It just kind of pushed everything out else out to the edges. and everything was seen through this boilerplate of devil worship. It also had aspects, racialized aspects to it. You know, so the stereotype of black devils goes back quite a long way in European Christianity. And in the torture trial period, this is something that is emphasized and driven into, it's like they just ingrained it deeper and deeper into the culture, the idea of black devils. And then there's the level of pornographic symbolism and obsession in the accusations, and especially in the trials. Those who were conducting the trials, the judges, the torturers, the jailers, were raping women in prison, but they were also performing sexualized torture. You know, so we have to look at the symbolism of those witch hunt, you know, the iconography of it and the ideology of it, the women being forced to parrot back the fantasies of their torturers, and the torture would not stop until they had said, yes, I went to the witch's gathering, I had sex with many devils, it was painful, his member was large and icy and cold, you know, and you get the black devil, so there's this trope of the black rapist that's also being propagated through these forced confessions. Mm. And the torture implements themselves, many of them, were specifically for sexual torture. And, you know, this is really upsetting, so I'm warning in advance, but, you know, there were iron implements that were in the 1500s on. There was one that was called the pear, and it was an iron implement with spikes, and it was thrust into the vagina or the anus, and then it would crank open like a speculum. And sometimes they would heat these before they inserted them. So the actual torture was a rape. In the torture and also in the public punishment, you also have sexualization going on, so that breast rippers were a very common form of punishment, torture, that were heated up and used. They would tear the women's breasts before they burned them at the stake. You know, so these are mass spectacles. And what we have to think about is the impact on European culture of these highly sexualized, demonizing female bodies, abusing female bodies in this very public spectacle, that would redefine what sexuality was, what women's bodies are, you know, who we are as females, because it's all being funneled into this very intense misogynist practice that is a performance, but it's also, you know, a punishment. The execution is not the only punishment. The whole process is a punishment. And there is, underlying all of this, this deep, deep socialization of female submission. That is the purpose of the trials, of the accusations, the fear of accusation forced countless millions of women to modify their behavior and that of their daughters in order to protect them. You know, don't go there. Don't say those things. Don't talk back to your husband. You know, oh, no, just let it drop. Don't let that guy, you know, you can't say anything about what he just did. And so this had, like, all kinds of long through lines that we're still feeling today culturally that are affecting us. And that includes the culture of sexuality in the mass media through pornography. Mm-hmm. Because think about it. Chains, dungeons, gags. There's a graphic that I'll have in one of my volumes that, you know, they have exactly the same type of gag being used as a witch's bridle in England in 1600s, maybe 1700s, that is exactly like something that is still being propagated as supposedly sexual in modern pornography. Mm. You know, the exact same shape of, you know, a thing that goes over the head and then the gag over the mouth. And those witches' bridles were another thing. It's not only just that women were being tortured, tried, and burned at the stake. That's enough already. But there were all these other lower-level humiliations and public enforcements of female submission. So the witches' bridle, fell into that category, and this has to do with the silencing and humiliation of women's speech, so that they would put these bridles on and women would have to stand out in public, or they'd be paraded through the streets, sometimes driven with a man and a stick beating her along the way. For what? Having talked back to her husband or some official, or just any kind of female speech could be punished. And the other part of this that I think is really important to understand, the reason I'm spending time working on these very unpleasant subjects, is that we're living with the legacies of all of this now in modern, supposedly liberated culture, because the silencing of female speech is still very much with us. It's an impulse that is unconscious and deep. It's involuntary. It's, you know, I don't think that there's really much awareness of how pervasive that is, you know, so that people, both men and women, respond differently to female speech than to male speech. You know, when they elevate male speech in authority, and female speech is stigmatized and attacked. You know, so this is very important for us, as, you know, in the backlash against feminism, which has been going on now for several decades, we see female speech as a very targeted area. And so that's important.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people, including historians, male historians, have denied, you know, have argued that the witch hunts were not only exaggerated, but they've denied that they were gendered. You know, people will argue that the witch hunts also targeted men. You know, is that at all true in terms of the fact that they targeted men?
There's so many angles to that.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, the overall numbers, there isn't really, I mean, you will have people argue, oh, well, you know, men were targeted too and stuff, but the numbers really are clear, and so is the testimony from those cultures. There was, there's a quote, there's a lot of quotes from, you know, men saying, well, you know, for every one man we burn 10 women. You know, this is in the early 1500s in Germany. In France, you've got a woman who's saying, you know, mais quoi, they say that all women are witches. You know, so there's really just, you, that's just, there's so much evidence to the contrary of that. Now, if we look at the men who are, so the main numbers that most sensible people will look at is that the overall proportion is basically 8 women to 2 men. You know, in some few countries which had very few witch hunts, relatively speaking, like Iceland and Finland, you have a greater number of males accused than females. However, in the case of Finland, the inland areas, which were more culturally Finnish, there were hardly any witch hunts at all in those areas. And, you know, it was primarily men who were thought of as sorcerers. But in the 1600s, when Sweden colonizes Finland, you have the importation of the anti-female witch hunt doctrine, you know, this whole Christian Diabolus doctrine. And so at that point, you start to see the accusations against females rise until it surpasses the accusations against males. And this is where the greatest number of witch executions are documented in Finland, and they're primarily of females. So even those supposed exceptions don't really stand up to scrutiny. Now, if we look at the men who are accused, there's another group of important patterns. And first of all, we have to just say that if men are less likely to be accused, if accused, they're less likely to be tried. If tried, they're less likely to be convicted. That's a clear pattern. But even those who actually are, who do wind up being burned or otherwise punished for witchcraft, there's a very strong correlation of these men to women relatives, female relatives who had previously been burned for witchcraft. And so there's a correlation there of the men who are accused being related to previous, you know, to female victims, basically, of the hunts. And then there's the massive gendering of the thing, by the fact that all witch hunt judges, all witch hunt torturers, the entire apparatus was completely male. You know, women are only there as victims and as accusers. And this is another thing I don't want to leave out, is that, because here again we're talking about modern legacies, where that habit of women accusing other women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Andrea Dworkin's comment here is very apt, because she has this great saying which sums it up, take her, not me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the fear that women were under, but also women's desire to leverage the patriarchal society to get what they want. And so if there was a female enemy that they wanted to get rid of, they could accuse her. And so you do have a lot of this horizontal accusation going on of women by women, and that there could be no patriarchy without female collaboration and complicity. You know, that's there. There's no question about that.
And
the beneficiaries are, ultimately, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, like, that idea, take her, not me, what I want to talk about is what's happening today. And you've talked a bit about the legacy of the witch hunts and the witch trials and how it's impacted female speech and how we view gendered speech and pornography and media and sexuality. But, you know, when we look at what's happening today in terms of feminism and our fight against patriarchy, it seems as though there's versions of witch hunts that are going on today in terms of what women can say about our own lives and liberation.
Oh, yes. And yeah, I mean, you know, and new stigmatizing names have come into play that cause a lot of women to, again, become afraid and hold their tongues. You know, and the thing that's ironic about this is it is still very gendered. So, yeah, that's why I think that doing this work is important, is that we need to be able to see and recognize the patterns of not just male authority, but the attacks on female authority, female right to interpret the world. I mean, feminism really arose this last, you know, I mean, in the second wave, there was just a huge outpouring of resistance and saying, you know, we can't allow it to be this way anymore, you know, and to really be able to call out and name all the kinds of subordinations and colonizations of women's bodies, women's speech, women's sexuality, you know, and the body is a very important axis of oppression. Sex oppression is something that we cannot allow to be driven off the stage. You know, that must be looked at because it's so foundational. And, you know, really, the patriarchy does not grow out of the gender binary. The gender binary originates with patriarchy, the enforcement of the sexual double standard, and that is really about the colonization of the female, is the basis for all of these rigidities, these gender rigidities that, you know, people are saying, you know, that they want to get rid of, and we should get rid of them. But not The problem is that I think there's a lot of unconscious enactment of enforcement against women's right to speak about our own oppression. You know, that we have to be able to talk about things that are actually sex-based, like our bodies, sexuality, our reproductive rights, which are under huge attack right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very retrograde to see that discourse being chivied at all around the sides because, you know, now we can't say mother or woman or uterus, you know. It's just so retrograde. And I do see a lot of the witch hunt climate happening around this, the name-calling that is so knee-jerk, and there's no conversation there. It's just name calling, end of story, goodbye, you know, delete, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that person got blocked. We're not going to hear from them anymore, you know. And so that where female speech, where's feminist speech?
Mm-hmm.
Then.
And the boycotting and the no platforming and the blacklisting and the blackballing And, you know, I kind of see a lot of that, you know, some of it's rooted just in regular old misogyny, and some of it's rooted in ignorance and not really understanding what the feminist movement is fighting for and what it's about. But a lot of it, I think, is based in fear, which is related to that thing that you said earlier, that take her, not me thing.
It's just like really old, old patterns of who is a legitimate target, you know, and women are a legitimate target in the way that, I mean, I don't agree with that statement, but I mean, you know, as far as the way these behaviors get acted out, somehow people don't want to see this targeting of women, this targeting of feminists. I mean, it's very interesting. It's not at all coincidental that it's the great bulk of the people who are being no-platformed are feminists. You know, they're not going after, I mean, there was that horrible example with they were trying to no-platform Julie Bindle, and then the extremely misogynist, racist, and also anti-trans man was, they were going to leave him in there until it was pointed out to him that to the no platformers that this guy was a really bad number, but they were going to overlook him because she was the target. Mm-hmm. She was the natural target. And, you know, I think that so there's such unconscious levels of misogyny, including internalized misogyny, because, you know, I just think that it's destructive. I think that, you know, we can, everything counts, you know. Gender violence counts as well as sex-based violence counts. You know, we can have a conversation about all those things. You know, but we should be able to have a conversation. We can't have a conversation under current conditions because the voicing of sex-based oppression is being ruled out of order. You know, and there's this replacement, this conflation of sex and gender is really destructive toward any kind of feminist analysis over the basic structures of patriarchy as political economic order.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell me a little bit more about this book that you've been working on?
Yeah, it's the book is called Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion. And the time span of this that I'm basically concentrating on for this volume is 700 to 1100. So this is like a tipping point historically because you still have a lot of pagan culture still active. You still have witches as healers. There's some very interesting material that I found. There's one piece from it's a French penitential book, and the bishop is on about, oh, you know, we have to, these ignorant people are bringing offerings to earth fast stone and to wells and to trees. And so, you know, he's basically downing these ethnic ways that have a lot in common with indigenous religion in other parts of the world. But here's the interesting part. I mean, that's kind of standard for the priestly denunciations of folkways in that time span. But an Anglo-Saxon translator added a phrase there for his cultural context. And this is about 1,000 years ago in England. And so he takes this French passage and he says, you know, and so these people who bring offerings to earth fast stone. And then he adds this one line, swa swa wikan te chas, as the witches teach. And so that's a very important piece because what it's showing us is that the whole academic idea of witches is basically they accept the idea of witches as devil worshippers or harm doers. And so there's been this big debate between pagans and modern academia over whether witches could be ever considered even to have anything to do with paganism. But the old sources in, you know, the early Middle Ages are very clear about this, that, you know, witches are pagans, and they say this in 100 different ways. And so that's a very important little nugget. Anyway, I'm basically tracking the folkways, the goddess traditions, the women's ceremonies around spinning and weaving, incantation, chanting over herbs, various kinds of ceremonies of healing, passing children through openings in the earth, that are, you know, being all railed against by various priestly authorities. And oh, there's a chapter called Names of the Witch that really kind of concentrates a different focus on what the witch is. Because we were all told, well, the witch is a harm doer, you know, bad sorcery, all these different things. And that's actually still academically the definition of witch. Like in anthropology, witch is defined as a harm doer. And, you know, they're very rigid about this. So they have basically accepted the inquisitorial framework, and they have carried it along. But in this chapter, Names of the Witch, I show, using a lot of linguistic information, that the titles that were given to witches in the various folk cultures of Europe mean healer, seer, knower, prophet, diviner, herbalist, and shapeshifter, so that they were really names having to do with spiritual powers. And so that we really need to have that knowledge, because the whole access to heritage for people of European descent in this case, and, you know, our connection to the rest of the world in the second instance, is all really there in the cultural record. It's just that it's all been, that whole web of culture has been ripped and shredded, so that there's these pieces all lying around, and they haven't been put together yet. And so we need to have access to that knowledge, and especially as women we need it, because there is a very strong emphasis on women. That it's not that they said that no men could ever do these things or that there weren't any such men, but there's a very strong cultural emphasis on female spiritual gifts in the witch traditions, and also on the female divine, which very strongly contradicts the Christian doctrine. You know, God is a male, he has a son, his prophets are male, the Savior is male, priests therefore must also be male, as Pope Francis is only yesterday reminding us. And so, you know, here's a completely different other cultural template where you have women who are the counselors. People are going to them, and the woman is saying, okay, you know, we're going to treat this trauma that you had or this illness that you had, and we're going to use earth and water and fire to do this, and we're going to go to sanctuaries, maybe old megalithic monuments, you know, maybe praying to ancestors, and that's a whole dimension too, ancestor veneration in pagan Europe. And we are going to transform consciousness through chanting and smudging and maybe circumambulation around a lake or bathing in a spring, just all these kinds of acts that we know from the curanderas in Mexico and the African isangoma, a lot of these same types of practices. Here they are happening in Europe. And there's a very, very strongly female-marked quality to these professions. And anybody could do this. That's the other thing, is that, you know, you have people who are regarded as experts in this, in these areas, but there's a continuum, so that, you know, folk wisdom says, well, okay, you know, this thing is going wrong, and here's what you can do. You know, the little rituals around the hearth that could shift things, you know, and bring help. So that's part of the book, and then another part of it is tracking the repression, the misogyny. I have a chapter on the early burnings. And when I get into the Scandinavian material, there's quite a lot of information also about cultural misogyny in, you know, some of the mythology, and also in the ways that men were very, very, this gets us into some interesting stuff about gender. They're very terrified of being seen as feminized in any way. And so there was a lot of very loud chest pounding and performance of intense masculinity around the sexual double standard, basically, that cast females as being lesser than men. And so that's just this one volume. And then there's going to be earlier volumes. This is actually volume 7 of a whole 15-volume series. Mm. And I wanted, in the earlier volumes, about those Greco-Roman repressions, as well as the female spheres of power in them, and Christianity and what all happened there, and the church patriarchs and the ideologies. Because, see, you know, when we're trying to talk about the witch hunts, there's many, many factors that lead us down this trajectory that eventually breaks out in mass burnings, you know. And so the ideologies of male supremacy and religion, you know, you have aspects of that that were active in pagan Rome. But then when the empire Christianizes, when the actual state apparatus and the emperors become Christian and begin enforcing really patriarchal doctrine in the name of religion, it takes on a whole other level of deep, deep cultural enforcement. Because now you're having women not only being externally colonized by, you know, beatings or other kinds of punishments for stepping over the line of what females are supposed to be able to do, but you are also having them being internally colonized through religious ideology that says, God does not want you to do this. You'll burn in hell if you do this. You know, there's this internal enforcement that the women are actually being trained to police themselves, which we also are still seeing going on.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much. I wish that we could talk for hours more, but we should probably wrap up. Thank you so much for talking with me and for all your tireless work. I mean, it's so important. I mean, you know this, of course, but all of this information is totally erased from our history books.
Yeah. And it's also being mythologized. And when you see mass culture, the Game of Thrones or whatever else passes as something vaguely historical, you know, it's being mythologized still in very male-dominant ways. I want to mention that on my website, which is suppresshistories.net, that there you can go to a link and see some information. There's the contents, table of contents for the book is there, and I'm going to be posting excerpts there as well from some of the chapters in advance of the book publication. So watch that space. It's over there on the left side of the main page. I've got a link for that, and you can find out more about what this volume is about, as well as a table of contents for the entire series of Secret History of the Witches.
Excellent. That's awesome. Thank you so much for letting us know about that, and again, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
You just heard an interview with Max Dashew, a feminist historian, founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, and the author of a forthcoming book called Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, part of a multi-volume series about women in European folk religion and the witch hunts. You can find more of her work at suppressedhistories.net. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current.
Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.